IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Welcome back to yet another episode of All Things Policy. I am Rudraj Govaikar, and today we are going to talk about online activism in China. Now, civil society or civil movements are an important part of any country. Especially in democracies, they can act as intermediate feedback until the next election cycle. Now, such movements have helped shape the public discourse, even rebel legislations in different countries and in different time periods. But when we think of civil society, civil movements, we generally think of, you know, so-called Western liberal democracies. And in certain democracies, civil movements and the right to protest are, you know, wedded into constitution or the political fabric, the societal fabric itself. But to think of civil societies and civil movements under authoritarian regimes is slightly different. And that's why today's topic, where we are going to discuss a civil society to a smaller extent, but online activism to a greater extent, is very interesting to me personally as well. To sort of spearhead this conversation, today I have Megha Parthi with me. She's a researcher attached to the China Studies subgroup at the Takshashila Institution. And along with Megha, I have Arjun Gayas, who will also join us in the conversation. So as I said, before we dive into the main topic, that is online activism in China, I wanted to ask Megha about a general state of civil society in China. How does the civil society exist in China? How is it different than liberal democracies? I'm pretty sure it won't be as open. And I'm also very curious to know that are there NGOs that sort of take up various issues, or is it very diffused and sort of an underground movement compared to other civil societies? So yes, Megha, can you tell me about this?
Hello. Thank you, first of all. Yeah, civil societies do exist in China, and they have existed for a very long time, actually. But the nature is, as you said, is very different from what we see in liberal democracies. I mean, for example, there are NGOs, but many NGOs are actually government-funded. And there are also foreign NGOs and then domestic NGOs. Actually, there is an estimate. The estimate differs based on the researcher, but there are at least 7,000 to 8,000 different NGOs, including foreign and domestic. But here is the thing, though. Whenever we see a discussion on civil society in China and general authoritarian regime in general, there is this tendency to just, you know, categorize people as either, you know, revolutionaries or, you know, or oppressed. But this approach has been criticized a lot by a lot of other scholars. For example, this Professor Jing Wong, she's founder and director of MIT New Media Action Lab. She says that the civil society and Chinese people in general prefer an incremental approach to any change rather than, you know, just erupting into protests. So she says there is this gray area where Chinese society and civil society in general operates. And she also says that the confrontational activities are in general not appreciated in Chinese society as, you know, philosophy or way of life. There's this tendency that powerful people should not, you know, lose face, and it's not considered good. So there's also a word for that. It's called, it means silent forbearance. So, you know, you have to be silent, and then you have to probably criticize or whatever actions you have to take, you do that in private, not in public. So this is very rooted in Chinese culture, as per Professor Cheng. So many people don't even realize it consciously, actually, that they are doing that, this, or they are practicing this philosophy or, you know, way of engaging with the civil society. And there's also great literature which, you know, somehow analyzes the relation between state and society. There's Elizabeth Perry, there's Mark Selden, Peter Hesgris, and Carolyn Zhu from... So literature is, you know, very much there.
Interesting. I didn't realize that the whole Chinese society looks at it almost using Stoic, so like principles of Stoic, to not complain Very interesting. So as our topic today is, you know, online activism, but I am assuming that before online platforms became, Chinese civil society did exist and they did have certain movements offline. This is like even before technology was available. So can you briefly just talk about that era?
Yes. So you see, online, whatever happens online is a reflection of offline activities or feelings. So even before the era of online activism, there was this whole different sect of civil society which engaged in trade unions, events organization, environmental groups, and they exist even today. There are a lot of non-governmental organizations. For example, is All China Women's Federation. It's still there, even though it is it acts as an NGO also as a government organ. Then there's the China Youth Development Foundation. Then there's China Foundation for Poverty Elevation. So civil societies, like offline, do exist. And they're very vibrant, actually. And there are also this case of, you know, localized cellular activism. For example, people probably are not part of any NGOs or anything. But if they find anything, you know, to not their taste, they'll just protest locally or complain to their local government. So there are also cases of that.
Interesting. So as you suggested, and as you mentioned, rather, that there is a very recent history of civil movements in China. But what we increasingly see, and you're tracking these events to a certain extent, that many of these movements are now moving online. But as we all know, you know, China famously, you know, monitors its internet and the activity of its citizens. So how do average Chinese citizen who wants to take up an issue go about on organizing things or connecting with other people who might have similar ideas or to even start a conversation online?
Yeah, so this one, which probably everybody knows, it's using VPN. So use VPN and then you can bypass certain categories of, you know, restricted keywords and things. But even then, Chinese state has tried to, you know, regulate VPNs and related technology companies too. So what people have done, they have come with innovative techniques to, you know, carry on the discussion. So they'll use indirect references, for example, code names for leaders and code names of concepts. So there's this meme type thing, like they call it actually agao, they call it, which roughly translates into spoof or memes. So they use that. Then they use tools which are already available, like for example, platform like GitHub. So they use that to, you know, carry on the conversation innovatively. They'll probably make a project on GitHub and then, you know, try to deposit things there. Or they'll convert the sensitive documents into something else using Morse code or something. So they do that. And it's very interesting, actually, to, you know, read examples and, you know, monitor that and read it yourself.
I just have a quick follow-up before Arjun has a question. So I recently read that the chat boxes of very popular multiplayer online games were being used by certain other groups, not in China, but in Europe, to coordinate activities. Because generally these groups, these chat functions in online multiplayer games are not generally monitored by government. Is there any evidence that you have come across where maybe gaming sites or gaming portals were used to communicate between Chinese citizenry who were involved later then into organizing maybe a protest or a certain movement?
So I haven't personally been part of or monitored any gaming activity, as I'm not into gaming that much. But I have read reports that during Hong Kong protests and also during some feminist groups use these kind of platforms just to, you know, circumvent the censors and also to be in touch with the diaspora abroad or, you know, carry activity abroad.
Hey, Megha. So I wanted to ask you something very interesting about organizations in China. So are there any specific organizations that advocate for the free and fair use of the internet or social media? So we have something like Internet Freedom Foundation in India, right? So that's an NGO which conducts advocacy on digital rights and liberties. They file petitions and undertakes campaigns for defending online freedom and all that stuff. So is there something like that in China which we can expect, or are there people who are working towards doing this? Are there like independent petitioners or litigators who take up these issues like online freedom, privacy rights and all that stuff, and then go ahead and, you know, file petitions against the government? I mean, it is an authoritarian regime, but people can still do that, right?
So freedom of expression is actually a very sensitive topic in China. I mean, there are organizations like Amnesty and probably Oxfam, which is based in Hong Kong, I guess. So this, in general, talk about freedom of expression and speech. I haven't come across any petition regarding, like as you mentioned in question. But then again, there are individual activists and, you know, some projects which do advocate this. For example, there is a GitHub project called Terminus 2049, which I'll talk about it this later. But yeah, this project has tried to, you know, collect all the censored articles or censored media, which is not allowed in China, and they try to deposit it on GitHub. So that is, and their motto is to, you know, preserve the freedom of expression.
Let's take a short break and we'll be back soon. Welcome back. Now let's continue our discussion about online activism in China. Now, before the break, we briefly discussed about the history of civil society in China before online activism became sort of the mainstay, and what tricks are used by Chinese citizenry to circumnavigate, you know, the Chinese surveillance. So building on that conversation, I am very curious to ask Megha, how does a typical campaign start? I'm pretty sure it starts in a diffused manner and then it picks up pace and maybe even it leads to a presence on ground. But I'm very curious that how does it actually happen, and do we know any famous instances of a successful movement as such?
Yeah, so this is actually the most interesting part of what I was tracking. What happens is online campaigns are actually, we can categorize them as either organized or spontaneous. So organized, and Arjun, you will love this, tech giants like Tencent and Weibo do used to hold this type of campaigns. They had everybody's a philanthropist or micro charities. So these giants used to have this annual functions, annual events, which would encourage people to, you know, donate to a charity or their favorite charity or sponsor charity, or they would collect the money and then donate it to some charity. So these kind of events. And the spontaneous ones are like, you know, spontaneous. For example, something happens and when somebody posts something and it just, you know, connects with the larger audience and then it snowballs into something different. Perhaps the best example, recent example of this would be this thumping or lying flat phenomena, which is very popular, which has become very popular. So that started with one of the, you know, forums where a user posted that, you know, lying flat is justice because there is nothing to do. And there's so much pressure that my philosophy to, you know, navigate through this life is I'll just lie flat and do nothing. So that resonated with a lot of people. And there was already, you know, a lot of pressure. There's a dichotomy that some people have a lot of pressure and, you know, pressure to prove, do something in life. And there are other people who are not finding enough work and do anything. So it kind of snowballed and it was so big that there were t-shirts being printed, then newspaper articles being written about it. It has also gained a lot of international recognition. And this combined with some other activities has also, you know, motivated state to do something about it. So this is a very good example. Yeah. Going back to this organized things, so there are also social media influencers and social activists who arrange campaigns like this, or they raise an issue, whatever the choice of their issue is, and then they kind of engage with people. Since they have a lot of following, they get a lot of, you know, views. So this is like typical how a social media ecosystem works, even outside China. But the difference is that the innovative way in which they do, for example, if some movement becomes too popular and state doesn't like it, there is a possibility of sanction. Even the thumping flat, which I mentioned, is many of the keywords of this were censored by China's government. because they didn't like the narrative getting negative online.
I just want to clarify one thing. So the Lying Flat campaign was not directed against a particular policy or particular government initiative. It was just citizens expressing their anger or discontent towards general quality of life or the pressures in modern day China, right? I am a bit confused about that.
Yes, yes. So this Lying Flat movement was not against any authority or, you know, in general policy, but this was about the general social construct, or, you know, how the society has become, how the social conditions have become, or especially discontent among millennials about the quality of life. That's why it became probably more popular, I guess.
Yeah, understood. Now, when you were talking about this, you mentioned that it could be, these movements could be organized, this could be disorganized and spontaneous. And you also mentioned social media influencers. Now, my brain sort of connected the social, you know, merit, social credit system and social media influencers. So what I want to ask is, are there any chances that, you know, if a particular social media influencer is getting too famous or he's really stirring up the pot, do we know that the social credit has been used to, you know, counter them, or have you come across any frameworks that talk about using the social credit system to keep a tab on online activists?
So social credit system itself creation is a very, you know, concept is very unpopular in outside. But social credit system, what it does is it encourages people to spy on each other. I mean, you have to rate people and their credit scores. It's not just credit scores, actually. However they behave, then you will be rated. For example, you, Ruturaj, we work together, and if you feel, I feel like, okay, your behavior is not up to the social conduct, I'll rate you, I'll downgrade you. And if enough people around you do that, your ability to take loans, for example, or fly out of the city might get affected. So this is itself you. So if I know your social handle and what you're doing online, or if you're, you know, spewing nonsense against the government online, which I feel is not good, I can, you know, report you. So that type of thing is very, you know, dystopian, I might say. But it also encourages people to self-censor. That's why it's very, you know, it hampers the discussion. But then again, if your online identity is not revealed to your group or, you know, other people, you might be safe. But apart from that, also social credit system. There have been a lot of instances where state has tried to, you know, guide the internet towards becoming a more civilized space. And even the recent guidelines, which were released in September, which talk about the construction of, you know, internet civilization or network civilization, there is this emphasis on inculcating socialist Marxist teaching and, you know, building your digital space based on that. And then there's this case of Wumao or, you know, 50 Cent trolls, which will be attacking you, not you as in anyone who is not seen nationalist enough to, you know, either troll them or, you know, attack your opinions or anything. So these kind of things act as, you know, inhibitor to freedom of expression online, or do an online activism, or engage with any political or seemingly political content.
A quick follow-up. Was there any opposition to implementation of the social credit system? As far as I know, I mean, it hasn't been implemented across all the regions of China. The implementation is very patchy. Do we have any instances where things were not rolled out because of resistance, or especially online resistance to this system per se?
There was some flutter, but there are also reports of this system being implemented smoothly. And now I have tracked mostly the positive and implemented instances. So I haven't looked at the negative or the resistance part of this. But then again, most of the policies which come from, you know, central committee, they are always implemented. So, you know, there's no question regarding that, if this will be implemented or not.
Okay, Megha. So let's move on to the last question. And what I wanted to ask was that can you elucidate on some instance where social media activism sort of, you know, led to a ground change that actually helped push back a policy or it brought a new policy? And how during such a instance, what were the innovative methods used by netizens? I mean, they could have been technology platforms or just novel use of existing technology platforms. I'm really curious about this.
Yeah, so there are a lot of examples actually, and I'll suggest people who are more curious about this to read Ms. Jane Wong's book, Other Digital China. But yeah, the most recent example and probably the best would be the 996ICU project on Jetta. So this was started by some anonymous software developers probably a few years ago. 996.ICU is a website hosted on GitHub, which is a software development platform. And it is not traditionally used for projects like this. It was used to collect data on Chinese technology companies, which make you work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. So that is why 996 and .ICU, because, it's a humorous play that if you work so much, then you'll just, go directly to ICU. So it was a little dark humor kind of thing. So what this project does is they make a blacklist of all companies which follow this practice, either overtly or covertly. And they also have a whitelist of companies. And they encourage all the tech workers or developers and engineers or even other workers who work for these technology giants to come and share their experiences or write more or, basically expose this system, which they don't find, good. So what happened was in 2020, around November, December, there were a few incidences of people dying due to this overwork conditions. Suddenly this project regained popularity and people became very interested in, there's protests, online protests, there's huge outcry online. And then combined with this lying flat thing, it became, it's spiraled. So state obviously became worried of the discontent that was being poured online and also the international attention this movement was getting. So in August 2021, Supreme Court declared this 996 practice illegal. And the Ministry of Human Resources and Social Security with Supreme Court also joined a statement. There was also criticism of this practice by state, leaders or local leaders. Then this is like one of those moments which I feel that this is like proper example of something, activism starting online and then its effect being produced on offline.
Oh, very interesting. I had heard of the 99 movement, but I didn't know that it actually went off all the way to Supreme Court and it brought some change. On that note, I will like to end this podcast. Thank you, Megha. Thank you, Arjun, for this interesting discussion on activism in China. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ruturajan. Thank you so much, Arjun, also. If you are more interested in knowing about this, then you should definitely read Gurbin Yong's work and also Ms. Jiang Hong's work. They are fantastic. Their books illustrate a lot of examples, which I didn't mention, couldn't mention here, regarding all the questions you asked. Those are excellent.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network.
On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.